Thank you. I'm going to start by reading you the prologue from the book. It's very short, but it will set the tone for you. I am braced in the companionway with just my head and shoulders above the deck, holding on so tightly my fingernails will leave marks in the wood. The cockpit enclosure protects me from the wind, which howls through the rigging, but it doesn't protect me from the salt spray, not entirely. Water drips through every little gap in the canvas, around the zippers, between the snaps. A wave breaks over the boat, drenching the cockpit completely, and for a minute I can't see anything through the plastic windows. Then they clear. I'm not sure which is better, seeing or not seeing. When we're in a trough, all I can see is a wall of water moving towards us. It's hard to tell how big the waves are, 3 meters, 4. Sometimes they just lift us up, pass beneath the boat, set us back down more or less gently. When we're on the crest of a wave, all I see is confusion in every direction. Waves crashing into each other, sending plumes of salt spray into the air. Sometimes a wave breaks beside the boat and we slew as the water boils around us. It's worse when a wave slams against the side with a heavy thud and the boat rolls sharply, then rights itself. But not as bad as when a wave breaks right over us with a mighty crash. The boat shudders sickeningly, then is still for a moment, and water pours out through the scuppers. Then it all starts again. I look down through the companionway. Chris is stretched out on the starboard settee, asleep, I think. How is that possible? His face is relaxed, peaceful almost, his graying hair a tousled mess. Who is this man, and what am I doing here? I could be back at my condo right now, sitting beside the fire, a glass of wine in hand, a big fat book open on my lap. What am I doing? I have to admit that that's a question that I often ask myself as we were sailing across the North Atlantic in our 43-foot sailboat. I am not a sailor. Well, I guess I am a sailor now, but I wasn't a sailor when this story started. I was living quietly in my condo with my books and my comfortable armchair. My marriage of 25 years had ended badly, and I had determined that I would never put myself in the way of a broken heart again. I was absolutely resolved on that matter. But I had a little dog, and Chris, who lived upstairs, had a little dog. And little dogs have to go out back to pee, so we often would meet sitting on the steps. It was actually the girls' entrance to the old school. It was kind of neat. And we'd sit there and we'd chat, and he would talk about sailing a lot, which I really didn't understand. And finally I said to him one time, what is all this sailing thing about? And I let him talk me into going out on his boat with him. So let me just describe what that first experience on the boat was like. I had never been on a sailboat before, was baffled by all the ropes, as I called them, not knowing a sheet from a halyard. Chris had me take the wheel as we motored out of the harbor and went forward to remove the sail cover. I watched him working on the foredeck. He'd stop from time to time, check our heading, a little more to the right, look around for other boats. "Ready to raise sail?" he asked. "What do I do?" "Just keep the boat pointing into the wind." I could do that. In no time he had the mainsail up. It fluttered weakly in the gentle breeze. "So this is sailing?" He came back and took the helm, and as we rounded the lighthouse and left the shelter of the harbor, the sail suddenly filled with wind and we picked up speed. He handed me a rope. "Make sure that feeds out and doesn't get caught on anything, especially your foot," and reached over and unfurled what I now know is the Genoa, sheeting it in with one hand as he steered. Then he switched the engine off, and the only sound you could hear was water rushing along the hull and the occasional cry of a gull. We were galloping through the sparkling blue water, wind in our hair. "Free," I thought. "I'm free." "You like it?" he said. "I love it." Chris was watching the sails, adjusting the heading a little to the left, a little to the right, making the most of the gentle wind. We were just two big kids playing outside. Well, that was the end of that. Before I knew it, I had sold my condo, quit my job, sold my car, sold all of my belongings, and moved aboard the sailboat with Chris, whose dream had always been to sail across the ocean. It was a steep learning curve for me because I had never sailed before, but we sailed around in the Great Lakes for quite a while doing increasingly difficult sailing. He's a canny fellow, my Chris. He first took me out on gentle day sails, and then we'd do a longer sail, and then a little overnight sail, and then a couple nights, and then sail in some storms. And by the time we'd sailed in the Great Lakes for a while, I felt that I was ready to head out to the ocean. So we left the Great Lakes in the fall went down the Erie Canal and the Hudson River to New York City, which was really cool. Sailing past the Statue of Liberty in our own little boat was really neat. Although when we got there, it wasn't much long after 9/11, I think a year or two after that. I can't remember exactly the date, but as soon as we got anywhere near the Statue of Liberty, we were surrounded by helicopters, and there were boats that came out with motor guns or machine guns mounted on them until they figured out we were a harmless, rusty Canadian sailboat, and they left us alone. After that, we hopped down the coast of the United States doing, you know, one night, two nights at sea, just as we, again, sort of getting used to what it felt like being out in the ocean. We had to winter down, it was a great hardship. We had to winter in the Bahamas. You only can cross the ocean in the spring, so this was late in the fall. So we spent our winter in the Bahamas and then went to the Caribbean. And finally, we set out on our ocean crossing from Antigua. So we had ahead of us at that point a trip of 2,600 miles from Antigua. You have to sail north to get the winds and the currents that you need to head out into the ocean and cross the ocean. So when we first set out, the sailing was so easy. I just couldn't believe how fantastic it was. It was warm and sunny in the daytime, you know, Caribbean weather, really gentle breezes coming offshore, so it wasn't, the waters were smooth, the moon was full. At nighttime, our boat would leave a trail of phosphorescence behind it. I'd never seen that before. It was just so beautiful. There were tropic birds sailing with us. It was, again, I had the same thought. I thought, wow, if this is sailing, I can do this. And then on our fifth day out, we hit our first big storm. So let me read what that was like for you. So this is day five at sea. It's mackerel with rice and peas tonight, a high-end version of boat gorp. Rice cooked in canned mushroom soup with a tin of tuna and a can of peas thrown in. From time to time, I look up from the simmering pot. I'm waiting till the rice is almost cooked to add the mackerel and peas. Outside the galley window, the sea is the most incredible shade of blue. I never get tired of looking at it. Sun sparkles on the water as far as the eye can see. We're sailing in a sea of diamonds. I cut the mackerel into chunks, stir it into the rice, dump in the can of peas. When I look out again, a band of puffy white clouds has formed on the horizon. By the time I emerge from below with two steaming bowls of gorp, they've turned into a band of dark clouds. I don't think it's going to rain, Chris says. He digs in. This is great. As we eat our dinner, he checks our position. Another 100-mile day despite the light winds. So far, so good. But the dark clouds are getting closer. They're also getting darker. They're almost on us by the time we finish eating. Maybe we'd better tie in a couple of reefs, he says, handing me his empty bowl. Why don't you go below and close up? When I get back, Chris has already shortened sail and zipped up the canvas around the cockpit. Maybe it is going to rain, he says. Big drops of rain are splattering on the windscreen, and there's lightning in the distance. Not the pretty kind that dances around the tops of clouds, but angry bolts of lightning are stabbing the water, and they're getting closer. We've never been struck by lightning, and may we never be, though they say that sooner or later every voyaging sailboat gets hit. In theory, steel boats are rarely damaged by a lightning strike, and injuries or deaths by lightning are uncommon. With so much steel in contact with the water, the electrical charge just dissipates harmlessly into the surrounding water, in theory. But I check the abandoned ship kit just in case, make sure it's zipped up, ready to go, in easy reach. My fear is that we'll get hit and Chris will be knocked unconscious, or worse. For the first time, I feel a long way from home. The wall of clouds is on us now, pelting, thunder crashing, lightning all around. Don't touch the steel, I remind Chris. You either. The wind heels us over, even with the tiny bit of sail we have up, burying the port rail in the water. 6 knots, 7, 7.5. Suddenly it begins to ease up. There, Chris says. I think that was the worst of it. He switches on the radar to confirm that the bank of clouds is moving away. Spends a little too long looking at the screen. Zooms out, then out further. What's wrong? This squall is moving off, but there's another one right behind it, and behind it, there's something so big and black I can't see the other side of it. I do the only sensible thing. I go below and put the spare GPS and the handheld radio in the oven, which is somehow isolated from the rest of the boat. That way, if we're struck by lightning and all our electronics are knocked out, we'll at least be able to tell where we are and call for help. Bless this woman, I think. I'm not naturally much given to prayer, but I did learn to pray while we were crossing the ocean. And that phrase, bless this woman, came up often. I heard it first when we were in the Bahamas before we set out on our crossing. And it's something that echoed all the way across. Let me tell you a little bit about my first encounter with this phrase. So we're in the Bahamas now. This is before our journey. I'm not suddenly doing my laundry in the middle of the ocean. That didn't happen. I put it off as long as I could. It was time to do the wash. The sheets were grubby, the towels stiff with salt, and I was wearing Chris's clothes because everything I owned was dirty. All he ever wore in the Bahamas was his bathing suit, which got clean every time you went for a swim. Our clothes weren't, I think I may have worn this once, dirty. They were mustard smear, lubricating oil, sweat stain, coffee dribble dirty. Finding a place to do the wash in a string of islands with no fresh water was a bit of a challenge. Fortunately, we weren't far from Black Point Settlement, a small town that seems to have figured out how to desalinate ocean water on a large scale. There was free fresh water available at the town tap. All you had to do was bring a wrench to turn the tap on and off. And wonder of wonders, there was a laundromat in town. We were anchored at Staniel Key, about 5 miles from Black Point, tucked in between two islands in a protected little spot. There was a front coming through that night, with strong winds that would clock around from the southwest to the northeast. We were pretty sure that if we pulled anchor and sailed to Black Point to do the wash, our spot would be gone when we returned, so we decided to dinghy there. The seas were calm, the afternoon sunny and warm, no sign of the bad weather to come. We packed our clothes into plastic bags, loaded them into the dinghy, and headed out. The plan was that Chris would leave me in Black Point and return to Staniel to fill the diesel tanks, which involved lugging jerry cans of fuel from the shore. I was pretty sure I had the better deal. Chris helped me haul our stuff from the public dock to the laundromat, a distance of about 3 city blocks, a unit of measurement that would make no sense to the people of Black Point. There's just one main road running along the coast. There weren't many boats in the harbor that day. Black Point is completely exposed to anything but an east wind, so the usually busy anchorage was empty, except for a handful of local fishing boats that looked like they could weather just about anything, and probably had. Chris helped me sort our clothes into washers, 5 of them, and pumped in quarters while I poured in the soap. Then I walked him back to the dock. Once he disappeared around the point, I turned and walked back through the town, feeling a little conspicuous. School had let out, and kids were straggling down the road in little groups, talking excitedly, calling to one another. They greeted me politely as they passed, suddenly on their best behavior. "Hello," they'd say, or "Okay, okay," which puzzled me. Were they asking me if I was okay? Telling me they were okay? I just wasn't sure. But I did get the feeling that they had been trained from a very young age to be polite to tourists. "Do you want to take my picture?" a little girl with at least a dozen red and blue and green plastic baubles in her hair asked me. The laundromat had turned into a hair salon by the time I got back. The woman who owns the place had moved one of the plastic chairs from inside out onto the front porch. In it sat a young man, his hair brushed straight up in the air. She was applying some kind of goo to it and braiding it into tiny cornrows. "Looking good," I said as I passed. "Look better soon," he grinned. I moved our clothes from the washers to the dryers, inserted more quarters, then leaned against one of the dryers, looked out the window. There were steps carved out of the stone going down to the water and a dock. We could have landed there and saved ourselves some hauling. There was a blue and white fishing boat at anchor just off the dock, bobbing gently in the waves. The water was so clear you could see the concrete block the boat was tied to, could see the shadow of the boat clearly on the sandy bottom. I was doing laundry in paradise. I was scared of Mom's wringer washer. All of us kids were. "Stay back," Mom would say, as she fished the clothes out of the steaming water with a wooden spoon and fed them through the wringers. "If your arm gets caught in the wringers, your bones will be crushed." This puzzled me. I'd seen the wringers pop apart when she tried to feed too many clothes in. Surely an arm, even a kid's arm, would trigger the safety release, but we stayed back. Mom continued to use her wringer washer long after everyone else's mother had moved to an automatic. "I don't trust them," she'd say, "and they use too much water." Mom would start boiling water for the whites as soon as Dad left for work. She would actually boil enough water to fill the tub, add detergent and a cup of bleach, stir it with her wooden spoon. She wouldn't use the agitator because without clothes in the tub, it splashed too much. She didn't want to risk getting bleach water on her apron or worse, in her eyes or ours. "Stand back," she'd say as she stirred cautiously. Then she'd add the whites, poke them down, set the timer for 10 minutes, let them agitate while she sipped her now cold coffee, run them through the wringers when the timer went off. The rest of the clothes would follow according to color and level of grime. The tea towels and tablecloth came next, then the sheets, then the bath towels, then our underwear and shirts, then our muddy pants. Sometimes she'd wash our running shoes before she drained the machine and filled it again to repeat the whole process for the rinse. It took her until mid-morning to finish the washing. Then she'd haul everything out to the backyard, give each item a fierce shake, and hang it on our flimsy, inverted umbrella clothesline. She would discreetly hang our underwear behind the towels and sheets, but I was mortified at having it out there at all. I didn't understand why we couldn't get a dryer like everyone else. When I left home, the first thing I bought myself was an apartment-sized washer and dryer, which I hauled from place to place. No way I was going to use a wringer washer, and there was something shameful, it seemed to me, about going to a laundromat. Too public. Too many bored people waiting for their clothes to dry. Nothing better to do than watch you fold your not-quite-clean tea towels. Now I seek them out, all that hot water and dryers that leave the towels nice and fluffy. So much better than washing things in salt water in a pail, rinsing them in the smallest amount of fresh water possible, hanging them from the rigging to dry. On a good day, you don't have to retrieve your bed sheets from the water and start all over again. I understand now, in a way I didn't then, that perhaps my mother wasn't just backwards. Maybe she took pleasure in doing laundry the way she'd always done it, the way her mother taught her. I remember watching her patiently fish our little socks out of the water and feed them through the wringers one by one. She would linger as she folded our corduroy pants and plaid shirts, shook the wrinkles out of our Sunday dresses, tied the ribbons at the back into pretty bows. She always smiled as she smoothed the baby's sleepers, folded the flannel blankets with bunnies on them. And there was no mistaking the satisfaction on her face as she carried the baskets of clean laundry into the house. I have trouble reconciling this version of my mother, so content with her small life, so fearful of everything, with the woman who understood my decision to go sailing, who pushed me away, in fact. I had been dreading going to the home to tell her that I was thinking of going sailing with Chris, but she didn't hesitate for a minute. She put her good hand on my chest and pushed me hard. "Go," she said. When the laundry was dry and folded and packed back into the plastic bags, I hauled it out onto the back porch, planning to sit on the stone steps and watch for Chris. Perhaps I could wave him in to the dinghy dock, save us lugging our laundry back through town. Outside the door, two women stood talking. Well, one was talking, the other was listening. The one doing the talking wore a brightly colored dress, red and blue and orange, and was holding a Bible in her hands. The other woman had a baby on her hip and was wearing a white blouse, a red skirt, and a wide-brimmed hat with elaborate trim. She looked like she had just come from church. They stopped talking, turned and looked at me. "Uh-oh," I thought. "Hello," I said. Okay, the one with the Bible sang out. She looked out over the harbor. "Where is your boat?" "It's in Staniel," I explained. "I've just come here to do my wash." "May I pray with you?" she asked. There was no getting around it. She tucked her Bible under her arm, took both my hands. Both women closed their eyes. I stared at the baby. The baby stared at me. "Lord, we thank you for this woman, this beautiful woman. We thank you for bringing her to our beautiful islands, the most beautiful islands in the world." "Amen," the other woman murmured. "Thank you for this woman, and keep her safe on the water. Keep her safe on her boat. Keep all the boats safe on our beautiful water." "Hear her," the woman in the hat agreed. The baby was still staring at me. I lowered my eyes. "Lord, bless this woman, this beautiful woman, and keep her safe. Amen." "Amen," murmured the other woman. "Amen," I said. They opened their eyes and smiled at me. The woman was still holding my hands. "Thank you," I said, squeezing her hands and releasing them gently. "Thank you." And I really meant it. The second squall has come and gone. I stand in the companionway where I'm safely, I hope, surrounded by wood. Chris studies the radar. There's good news and bad news. The good news is I can see the other side of the next squall, and it looks like it's the last one. The bad news is it's 4 miles wide. I brace myself for the worst. How can 4 miles of thunderstorms pass over us without at least one direct strike? "Never get caught out on the water in a thunderstorm," I can hear my mother saying. "You'll get hit for sure. Never stand under a tree, or anywhere outside for that matter. Lightning can travel through wet ground, strike you dead before you know it. Not that you're safe inside. Don't ever touch an aluminum window, or stand near the stove, or the sink, or worse, between the two. If lightning hits the house, a fireball will come out of the stove and arc to the sink. Go to the basement, stay there, it's the only safe place." After the first half hour, I find myself releasing my death grip on the sides of the companionway and even watching the lightning rather than squeezing my eyes closed at every flash. The wind is fierce, the rain torrential, but they're nothing compared to the lightning. A deafening crash, then a jagged streak of light. How close now? I start to count. 1,002. I never get past 2. The storm is right on us. Lightning strikes the water to the left of the boat, to the right, leaving us completely blinded between flashes. It's terrifying, but it's also really quite beautiful. In a holy cow, I wish I were watching this on TV kind of way. Bless this woman, I keep repeating to myself. Bless this man. Keep them safe on the water, the beautiful water. Something happens during that first storm at sea. I find myself surrendering. What else can I do? I feel very small out in the wide ocean in the violent storm, but I feel something else. I feel free somehow, and it's kind of a release. There's nothing I can do. So that was our first big storm at sea. Mercifully short, only lasted for maybe a couple hours altogether till all the thunderstorms had passed over us. And then the weather cleared again, and we were back into the beautiful warm sailing as we continued to move north towards Bermuda. Then when we reached Bermuda, the latitude where you have to make the turn actually out into the ocean to cross it, things began getting steadily worse. It was colder, the seas were much rougher, the weather pattern had changed, so instead of having a gentle breeze on our beam, which kept us sailing along gently, we were pounding into the waves and moving really fast because the winds had just picked up so much. And it was rough and cold and really the most trying part of the journey, but we got through it, and we were getting close to making landfall and starting to feel very, very optimistic when we were absolutely clobbered by not one, but two huge gales that we didn't know they were coming, because we had managed to lose our single sideband radio antenna, which is how we got weather information, so we were essentially sailing without weather information. We did talk to a passing ship and say, you got a weather report, and they said, yes, there's a big front coming, but it's going to pass north of us, so we should all be fine. We weren't. It was a huge, huge gale. And it lasted about, we hope to, rather than trying to sail through it, just let the boat ride it out. It lasted about 18 hours. It was really terrifying. I was terrified. And then it let up, and we thought we were in the clear. And then we were hit by a second gale. Let me tell you about this gale that we experienced our last night at sea. So once the first gale had passed, this is where this starts. The weather seems to clear a little as the day wears on. There are even a few brief sunny periods. We don't even try to clean up down below. We just sprawl in the cockpit, take turns napping on the bench, and I don't bother making any food. Neither of us feels at all like eating. We just nibble on crackers, drink as much water as we can. We'll make landfall in the morning. We can clean up then, eat some food, but not before we fall into bed and together and sleep and sleep and sleep. As dusk falls, I make us some tea, then send Chris below to try to get some sleep before his night watch. The clouds still look strange. I'm almost relieved when the light fails and I can't see them anymore. The wind seems to be dropping. Just 79 miles to go, our last night at sea. We should be able to see Flourish when dawn breaks. June 16th, day 26. Chris has had a quiet watch, and I'm hoping for the same. Around 2 a.m., the wind suddenly dies, and I think, good, we're out of it now. I'll bet when morning comes, the dark clouds will have disappeared, but an hour later, the wind suddenly starts to build. I call Chris to help me reduce sail. We crank in the Genoa almost all the way, tie a third reef in the main, just in time. A wall of wind hits us like nothing either of us has ever felt before, on land or at sea. It must be at least 60 knots, well beyond gale force, verging on hurricane force. We need to heave to now, Chris says. I don't like the edge in his voice. I brace myself, and as we crest the next wave, Chris turns us into the wind. We need the bow to come across the wind in order to backwind the foresails and stall our forward motion, but it doesn't happen. As we come up on the wind, the boat picks up speed and heels over sharply, but the tiny slip of Genoa we have is out too much. We can't get across. As the wave passes under us, the boat rolls on its side, the mast at a 45-degree angle to the water. A winch handle slides out of the cockpit, bounces on the cap rail, and disappears into the foaming seas. The mainsail is flogging uncontrollably, the boom banging back and forth. The foresails are blocking its wind. Can the rig take this pounding? The boat is actually shuddering, something I've never felt before. I glance down the companionway at the abandoned ship kit. When the wave has passed under us, Chris eases the wheel and we fall off the wind. The boat rights itself somewhat, and the main fills with wind. We're back where we started. We need to take in all the Genoa, Chris says, but he can't leave the helm. It's not safe for me to go forward, so I have to crank it from the cockpit, inch by inch. Okay, now hold on, Chris says needlessly. I'm holding on as hard as I can. We're going to try again. As we reach the top of the next wave, we heel over more than I would have thought possible. Then suddenly we're across the wind. The mainsail tacks itself and fills with wind, and the storm sail backwinds, stalling the boat. Chris turns the rudder hard so it's working against the backwinded storm sail, then makes tiny adjustments to the wheel until we're taking the building seas at the best possible angle. This time Chris doesn't suggest that we go below. Wordlessly we watch the rail on the leeward side, flirting with the churning seas. My heart sinks. How high will the seas build in these winds? What will we do? I don't ask. If it doesn't capsize us, this wind could blow us past Florege, I think, grimly, or worse, right onto its rocky cliffs. We can't reduce sail any further. Oh, we can. We watch as the wind tears our storm sail to shreds. I've had enough of this. Maybe I'm not as brave as I thought. Then the wind dies as suddenly as it came up. We can't believe our luck. Chris switches on the engine and starts motoring cautiously in the direction of Florege through very confused seas. I sit numbly beside him on the cockpit bench, staring through the windscreen. It's just starting to get light. The strange colored clouds are gone, replaced by low, ugly clouds. We can't see more than a mile ahead of us. We pick up Florege on the radar long before we can see it. On a clear day, the guidebook says, you can see Florege from 40 miles away. We are just 4 miles from the island, and we can't see anything but a dark band of clouds where Florege should be. Then I spot a funnel of white rising from the sea up into the dark clouds. Now what? A waterspout? Chris unzips the windscreen to get a better look. Then he grins. Take a look. What we're seeing is a waterfall plunging down the face of a cliff. Land. We're seeing land for the first time in almost a month. We have crossed 2,300 miles of ocean and ended up exactly where we wanted to be. Sure, we have a chart plotter, but the charts for the ocean aren't very detailed. And we have a GPS to confirm our position and paper charts to mark where we are. But our arrival here is still a wonder to me. To both of us, I think. Thank you. So I've read you mostly about the wild parts of the North Atlantic. The middle of the ocean is one of the truly wild places left in the world, and it does test you, tests your strength, and it tests your courage. But also on the long night watches and some of the nicer days, it's a place to think and to dream and to try to make sense of your life. And I'm really glad that we did it, and I'm a different person than I was before we set out across the ocean. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have about sailing or writing or living in a condo with a little dog, anything. Yes. Oh, it was so hard on my confidence and self-esteem, you can't even imagine. I was terrified of everything. I mean, thunderstorms, that was just one of the obvious things to be afraid of. There are so many other things to be frightened of, and it's taken me, I think it took my ocean crossing till I stopped being fearful, but it'll still bubble up sometimes. She instilled in me a fearfulness that has never gone away. Yeah. Well, I've been writing my whole life, but I only, I guess in my 20s I started writing seriously, but one of my earliest memories is of, so Mom had 7 children, which, I don't know, that might explain some of her nervousness and fearfulness, I don't know, but didn't know what to do with all these children, so we had this enforced quiet time in the afternoon where you were supposed to go to your room and nap, and if you couldn't nap, you just had to be quiet and stay out of her sight. So what I would do is I had a notebook, and I would crawl under the back porch, weird but true, but it was a lovely private space when you're a family of 9, and I would write little poems and little stories and things, and I'm really very grateful that I've lost that notebook and will never be able to find it. But since then, I've always kept a journal. In my 20s, I started writing short stories. I've just always written. This is just my first chance to write a book, going across the ocean. Let's see, Chris helped me find the courage. Maybe I found it myself to sail across an ocean, but that also gave me the courage to write a book, to think, you know what, I have a story, and I think it's worth telling, and I think I'm a good writer, and I'm going to tell it. Yeah, so thank you. He was really okay with it, because he comes out very well in this book. In fact, the editor of the first draft said to me, you have to go back and tell us about some of Chris's faults. You really can't just have this guy who can do everything and is great. Now, my ex, that's a different question. He does the marriage of 25 years part. He is that story. So one of the things I decided on this crossing, I had never really spoken about what happened at the end of our marriage, what that was like for me, because I didn't think it was my story to tell. I mean, it was my story, but it was his story too. Oh, sorry. And I didn't think it was the thing I should talk about. But then I finally, when I finished the first draft of the book that was just this big adventure story, again the editor said, unless you tell us where you came from, what your experience was before you set out across the ocean, what your childhood background is, just is a story of some woman who jumps in a boat with a guy and goes sailing. So I had to go back and dig into all that story and put it into the book. And we have not communicated, my ex-husband and I, ever since forever. And my great fear is that I'll show up at something like this and he'll be in the audience, so I'm glad he's not here. That's a tricky one. I have to remind myself when I'm doing something public, I have to tell myself again, okay, this is your story too. You get to tell this story. And I think I'm very fair. I hope I'm very fair about it.
Yeah, I have another question. Did your ex-husband ever support your writing career?
Never. Never.
So that explains it.
Yeah. Actually, that's true. It was only after the marriage ended, like I squeezed in some short stories and writing some little short fiction, but that was not an approved activity, especially because we were farming together, and I was, again, no sailing background, no farming background, then I was suddenly a farm wife, and there were all these things that I was supposed to do that certainly didn't allow any time or space for writing. Yeah, that's a good question. I only wish I were that disciplined. When you're sailing, you're required to keep a ship's log that you have to enter in several times a day. I'm never sure who requires that, but you're required to do it. And you'd have to put your position and the wind speed, the conditions. And because I'm a writer, I would put that in, but then I would also put in what we had for dinner, and Chris was grumpy, and what else was going on. So our ship log was kind of interesting. I kept a journal when it was smooth enough to do that, when I could actually write without throwing up. So I would say probably every couple of days I'd do a big long journal entry about what was happening. And I also kept an ongoing letter to my sister on my computer when it was really smooth. I could rarely send it. When the SSB antenna was still there, I could send the letters home to her and she'd write back. But in writing that out, I captured a lot of the experience too. So when I came back home and decided to write the book, I had this material to draw on. Oh, Flourish, it's an island. It's the first island that you encounter in the Azores, a group of islands about 800 miles off the coast of Portugal.
Oh, okay.
Magical place. It's one of our favorite places we've ever sailed. It's really, really a beautiful place. Yeah.